This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
I didn't realize I wasn't mentally retarded until sixth grade.
I turned around to all the little boys with whom I was playing. I said, "Don't worry, formalitate. No, nothing to worry about."
I went on wonderful walks with my daughter.
Does not hurt, so don't worry.
So we did a lot of not knowing if we were staying or going.
I was ready to be back. I'm ready in the sense that I understood this nation a little more.
I landed in a different community, in culture shock, in grief, and in menopause.
So after this experience, life is beautiful.
Welcome to our studio in Sebastopol, California. And we're just back from doing a performance in San Diego and a long drive down and a long drive back. California is long. And our finches have flown.
The five baby birds that had a nest on our bedroom windowsill.
They're just about 6 inches from our large eyes.
We have to sneak a peek around the curtain. But now they're out of there. They were really hanging all kinds of parts of themselves over the edge of the nest before we left. So we thought, well, I bet they're going to go soon.
And stretching out their wings and hitting each other with the elbows and so on. But when they were smaller, I looked out there and early morning when they just screamed bloody murder. And the parent bird was stomping around on this little ball of fur. I thought, my God, are they dead? And then suddenly five beaks shot straight into the air, and she fed the birds. And I thought, this is a very strange way to wake your children up, by stomping on them.
Well, it's probably effective to get them to leave the nest. So now they're out of there.
They got out. So they are making their journeys. And this is a show about journeys. Your trip back home or overseas or up the mountain or the corporate ladder or down the hall to the principal's office, over the river and through the woods.
Trips where you came back slightly altered. We'll start out with three short stories from longer conversations. You've heard a couple of these folks before, and one is coming up soon.
I went to this hotel in Darjeeling, and it was freezing, and there was a light blanket and no heat. So I said, "Is there anywhere else?" And he says, "Taj Hotel, central heating." And I went there, and you have to pay a little more. And I went up to the room, and it was just as cold as the other. So I said, what's up with the heat?" And he said, "This is West Bengal, nothing but I can wait 30 minutes. And an hour later, there's a knock on the door, and an Indian midget was there with this little space heater on his head. And he puts it in the center of the room, and with a flourish of his hand, he says, "Central heating." I said, "That's not central heating. That's when it comes out of the walls." And he said, "No, that's America style. This is Bengali style." So he plugs it in and it doesn't turn on. I said, "Where's the heat?" He said, "Load shedding," which means brownouts, because there's not enough power. It doesn't come on for a couple of days.
And I'll never forget, we were in Georgia, and it was a two-lane road, and it was red clay on both sides. And we went into, it was lunchtime, and it was deep, you know, just so south. And my father and my mother and my brother and I walked into this cafeteria. There was a donation can that said, "Donations for George Wallace's presidential campaign." And my father looked at the man and said, "That's a dirty word where we come from." And I remember this look of complete terror on my mother's face. And I remember my father could be he's a very confrontational, very argumentative, very loved to start things. And I just remember pulling on my father's shirt, trying to get my father to, you know, back away from what I perceived as being a dangerous discussion, and my father taking his elbow and throwing it backwards and like punching in the mouth and me sprawling on the floor while my father got into this fight with this man about George Wallace. And then going out onto the parking lot, which was red clay, and just sitting there in the parking lot crying because my father was more concerned about proving his point to this man than he was about protecting me.
And the other very notable trip was when I was 19 and I was traveling to the other grandparents with my family without my husband. And we were hit by a drunk driver. And the car was turned over into a field. And the passenger side of the car was up as it stopped turning. And as I began to figure out what we were doing, I could hear Mother saying, "Oh, he's dead. He's a wonderful man. He's a fine father. He's such a fan. He's dead. Oliver's dead. Oliver's dead. Oliver's dead." And finally, I heard Daddy say, "Inez, I'm not dead, but you're on top of me."
We were talking with Mark Gold, Sarah Savitz, and Elspeth. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
So today, we're talking about, I don't know if there's a theme exactly. Maybe it's people on journeys where they're trying to figure out the theme. Actually, you know, we do not have a theme. I mean, who started this whole business about having themes?
I don't need a theme. I really appreciate those mornings when I can get up and find out what's the day going to bring to me and I don't have to have a list to make it do it.
Maybe that's a salutary antidote against romanticizing this journey business too much. It's, you know, it's very much in our bones. Get out and seek your fortune and slay the dragon and go to Hollywood. But, you know, we're thinking about the finches and the baby finches. They just sit there. They're very alert. They're all facing west, waiting for mom and dad to come back with a mouthful of bugs and divvy it out.
Seeds, I think.
Seeds. But any human being past the age of two who did that would just be called a bum unless he was living on his investments and just watching television.
Facing west. All right, all right. Let's not get too wrapped up in our metaphor of transformational journeys. It's okay sometimes just to sit there with your beak open. So maybe you have a story about a time when you didn't make a journey, when the journey came to you. Send us an email through our website, www.independenteye.org.
Somebody asked, where do you find these people? And actually, we have commissioned the human race to come up with material, and they do.
Our next story doesn't really have a clear plot, but I think there is a strong drive. It's a friend who's hunting through the debris of a very cluttered world, looking for his soul.
Sam Reynolds. We knew Sam as an actor in Philadelphia. Light-skinned African-American, very short, slight limp, a brilliant improviser. And it wasn't for a long time that we really had any clue about the multiple lives he's lived.
I was born 1967, and it was discovered that I was missing a kidney. I had clubbed feet. Basically, I had spina bifida. And over the course of the next 9 years or so, I underwent the majority of the 20 or so operations I've had in my lifetime. Make a long story a little shorter. I mean, even though I started school for mentally retarded children, I didn't realize I wasn't mentally retarded until maybe sixth grade. And I was going through the whole bout of being angry, and I was, you know, I'm short, and I was shorter then. And having kids pick on me, and picking on kids too. And it came down to a discussion with my principal, and basically said, like, if you don't straighten up, you're gonna get thrown out of here. It was a public school, but still, I mean, it was like, wow. I couldn't imagine my life without school, even though I hated it.
I thought of doing this interview when Sam told me he'd been a 12-year-old preacher. Well, that's interesting. So it was surprising when he said that was the place in his life where he felt the most alien.
When I went into the ministry, I was a very serious person. And, you know, like I said, I was very literalist and fundamentalist. So the idea of this kind of fuzzy cultural institution, even though I appreciated the music, really made me feel uncomfortable because I wanted people to get the word. And so with the preacher, you know, for instance, like the whooping and hollering, and God, early one morning, got up, and that whole thing, I despised it because I wanted to just tell people, I wanted to be like Joe Friday, just tell the people the facts, just the facts. But I came, as I got older, more to question the Bible, the church, Eventually, I remember feeling like Lucifer, feeling like I know everything these people know about the Bible, but I know it's false. That's, I think, the time when I have felt the most alien. I went into the ministry because literally, I felt a calling. I heard voices. I had always wanted to be a detective or criminologist. And I had just accepted, believe it or not, before I went to camp. This was at camp. I accepted Jesus. I had declared atheism, myself as an atheist, before that. And I don't know, I was a kid. It was seventh grade. Like, I remember thinking when I was like six that God was really an escapee from another universe. And just decided, just like, I'm going to create my own universe. And I guess, you know, trying to tie the different loose strands of my life and the reasons for surviving, you know, the 20 operations I had, I felt this compulsion like, well, there has to be a reason. Jesus. So I became a Christian. The next week while I'm in church at camp, I hear this voice in my head, Samuel. But I wasn't clear it was in my head, so I tapped my friend. I was like, did you say something? No. I hear it again, Samuel. Tap my friend again. What do you say? Why do you keep calling me? I'm not calling you. And then they called me by my full name. And I said, what do you want? And said very clearly, I want you to preach. Me? I don't want to be a preacher. And then I said, I don't want to be a preacher because there's no money in it. And, you know, at least I knew as a criminologist, I'd get some money, I'll get paid, and it was fun, whatever. But being a preacher, what do you mean? And I agonized about for 2 days. And I decided, I guess, well, I should go into the ministry. And that was a pretty straightforward decision, even though it had some overtones in some respects of mysticism, you know, the voice. Possible schizophrenia, who knows. But what was compelling for me was when I came home and I told my mother I had decided to go into the ministry. She got really quiet. She said, that's funny. Because Granny, my great-grandmother, said, just before I went to pick you up, she said, out of the blue, go get the preacher. So a friend who had been at our church had joined another church, and she asked me to come to her church. Went there, met the pastor. He took me under his wing and gave me some books to study. And I preached my first sermon on my mother's birthday, September 28th, 1980. And that's significant also, not just because of her birthday, but there's a whole series of other steps I had to take too. I was a boxer from age 9 to 12. My father was a fight trainer. And when I was going through those bouts of being really angry and getting in a lot of trouble, he decided, well, I might as well channel it and teach me how to box against my mother's admonitions. And it was a hard thing for me to leave boxing. Because, you know, I knew it would hurt my father. My father had gotten very attached to me boxing. But through my own 12-year-old logic, I just couldn't justify beating someone up on Saturday and then preaching about love on Sunday. And I told him initially that I was getting out of boxing, and he was like, sure, sure, sure. Would tell him again, yeah, all right. Okay, now what you're going to do is you're going to get in the ring, and you go on about it. And then I took my mother about my frustration. I was like, he's not listening to me. He still has the letter. He still has the letter to this day. He's like, I guess you are quitting. And he was fine with it because he couldn't argue with the man who was going toward God. So my mother even made some cheesy posters, you know, my first sermon to me as a pastor about how he goes on and saying, I'm a boxer, now I'm fighting for God. Yeah, the first time really was a very powerful time. I was amazed by how natural it felt. I knew that place. I could be here. I just felt like, oh, I know this. It was the first time I ever saw my father cry, because afterwards there was testimony. And he got up. He stood up. I can't remember exactly what he said, but I think, you know, he was very happy to see me preaching, and he started to cry, which floored me. My father is, you know, 6'1", 2", former boxer, tough guy. I mean, like, he's been to prison. He went to prison for beating up cops, you know, a rebel, So to see this guy crying just floored me.
And then the road took a sudden turn.
I went to college, went to Syracuse University. Basically, I uncovered like the truth I had felt at the time, you know, the truth about Christianity, the truth about being black in America as an oppressed black man, you know, I'm getting the whole rhetoric of that time. Changed my name that my father could never pronounce or would tease me about. It was Samuel Ibn Akhenaten Reynolds. For him, I was Samuel Ibn Akhenaten Reynolds. So by the time I got to graduate school, the last thing to go was God. And I came to one night in December of 1991 where I say God died in my life.
He went fervently into black nationalism, but that faith unraveled too, then into theater. But he had a college friend from India and a long-standing invitation. So he went.
Oh, God. What had an impact on me? You know, in theory, and, you know, through the writings of different people about the sense of freedom that African-Americans experience, like in France, in Europe. But in India, it was a psychic sense of freedom. I understood something, which was I was not what America had conditioned me to be. In India, I just felt like mostly I could fit in until I opened my mouth. You know, I remember before going to India, I was in a massage therapy class, and a massage therapist who is the kind of new age executive, you know, teacher, the new age person who has a very fuzzy way of talking, a very fuzzy sensibility, but a very sharp business mind. So, but I remember her saying, you know, oh, you're going to India. The people there are so spiritual. When you look in their eyes, you just see like the millennia of spirituality and depth. So I thought about that spirituality as I'm, you know, on the train and the toilet is inoperable because you can't even stand the smell of going into the bathroom. But what I'm saying is about India is that what is most profound about India in terms of the spiritual lessons I learned, I didn't learn them at an ashram. It's an understanding a different way of life. Sometimes you have to go along for the ride. You have to go along with the ride even. And the Indian flag, one of the key features of it is the wheel of Dharma. And I never thought anything about it, but you know, when you're traveling through India, you will get frustrated if you think in terms of the American sensibility of like, that things have a certain way of happening. You know, like going up to the rickshaw, the auto rickshaw driver. you know it's just like the set rate to go from like Brooklyn to Manhattan would be 50 rupees, right? They see you and be like, oh, my meat is broken. It's 150 rupees, huh? And for a while, we were always battling rickshaw drivers. And then it hit us. Sometimes you just have to go along for the ride. You know, in the Gita, you know, what is Krishna saying to Arjuna in the chariot? Go along for the ride. Right? You know, like, do what you're supposed to do. And it helped us. Without trying to be patronizing, you also can say, oh, your meter's broken? And then turn on his meter. I was like, oh, it works fine. Let's go. And then, you know, you all have a laugh, including the rickshaw driver, because it's a game. But I had a friend I met in this community, and this woman, she once joked with me, but she was kind of serious too. She said, you see, Sam, America may have the roads, but we have the path. Which I love. There is this level of spirituality that's, you know, from the range of fecal matter to the ashram that permeates the sense of life. There was a phase to it when I first got there and I was like, you know, loving all things India. India is great. You know, America, bad. You know, America does this backwards. But by the time Elena joined me later, I still loved India. But I saw its flaws, too. And it has made me appreciate being American. And I don't mean that in a kind of, like, patriotic, you know, we wave our flag way. As much as there is a sensibility that we have in this nation that we bring a spirit of can do, that we can do. It's like, what do you mean you can't do that? What do you mean you have like just 6,000 years of civilization say that that can't happen? Sure you can. Watch. But for the most part, I respected that sense of the culture, but at the same time, I felt like I was learning a lot from the East, being in the East, but at the same time, it made me appreciate the West.
And what was it like coming back?
Oh, God. As soon as I came back, I felt, I can't explain it any other way, I felt the psychic drone that kind of permeates my consciousness as a black person in America. This slight measure of visible invisibility, I would describe it here. So coming back here into that, you know, American propriety, that kind of tightness that we have, which also serves us. I mean, we're a brutally efficient nation. Coming back from a brutally inefficient place, really, initially was a shock, but at the same time, I adapted very quickly.
Buffalo to Syracuse to Philadelphia to India, now Brooklyn. Boxing to preaching to acting to what?
Throughout, you know, even a lot of my failings, not my failings as much as falling away from aspects of belief to the brink of nihilism, something has remained, which is astrology. Then I don't know how it happens. You start getting this glimpse of not just like the psychology of astrology, but the spirituality of astrology. You know, like how Venus in this most crass stage can lead to lust. But ultimately, if you embrace it without attachment, it's love. It's true for Libra, right? I believe in the idea of the soul, but I don't know about God. I'm not ready to call, you know, the whole fabric of a contingency of a contingent life God. But as I'm studying these things, I'm realizing this kind of synchronicity between what's happening on Earth and what's happening in the heavens and how things kind of manifest. I realize I do believe in God. I do believe that there is a consciousness that permeates all of us, and at the same time, more importantly, is us. And so what's happening now is I'm starting to feel this compulsion, this drive toward active service. So it's funny, I've been thinking a lot about the ministry, because I don't have to feel like the devil anymore. You know, someone says to me, do you believe Jesus literally got up early one morning, Sunday morning, and rose from the dead? No, but it doesn't matter. It's a mythos. It's Aries. You know, there's no accident that Easter comes during the time of Aries over the Passover. Things happen in cycles. Things happen according to a time. And it's more a consciousness we're talking about than literal events. The resurrection can happen with you. I'm not angry at my Christianity or anybody's Christianity anymore. You know, I get angry with some of the fundamentalist aspects of it, but in general, I had my Bible out last night, get my Quran out another night, you know, and the Gita, these are all important lessons that apply for different people at different times.
Sam, what is home for you?
Someplace I will create. I think a lot about home. Because even here, I mean, we've created a beautiful apartment, but it's not home. Buffalo's not home. India, I like the joke about is home. But India's changed, I've changed, so when I go back, it's not going to be the same. So home is an aspiration I have, I think, that one day I will create a community. Where you just know you've created this community of people, and you know that you're with your own.
In Brooklyn, we were talking with Sam Reynolds.
That's our trips for this week. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map, a production of The Independent Eye. To listen to past shows anytime or to contribute stories, visit our website at www.independenteye.org.
And we're actually up and running with web commerce.
Yes.
Thanks to our web spinner volunteers, you can purchase CDs of the shows or anthologies.
Ear Trips, 10 dramatic pieces from the show, or Life Journeys, 5 of our favorite real-life people. One person wrote after hearing it and said, "Is there really a Fred Ponslow?"
You tell him, Fred. Hitchhiking is supported by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Hitchhikers Guild, which you can also join online, all with a wave of your credit card.
Many premiums, including a membership card and a free trip around the sun. If you live in the United States, you can fly first class.
Next show, we speak to a woman whose many voices have become one, a journey of integration.
And in this age of corporate responsibility, the Three Stooges test their survival instinct. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller, offering no travel thoughts at all for the week this week. Don't think about it. Do it.
I went to Puerto Rico when I was 7 years old. And it's amazing for me because, I mean, most of my childhood is a blur. But what's fascinating is that Puerto Rico, I remember so much of it. I remember looking at Sesame Street in Spanish. You know, I was able to say good morning and learn the numbers. And it was remarkably clean and so, you know, looking back, I wouldn't expect that. Of course, as a child, I didn't think, oh, it's clean. But I remember thinking, at least, wow, it's cleaner than Buffalo. And, of course, you know, just being in the tropics and seeing palm trees and being on the beach, I think that definitely affected me. Not just being somewhere warm, but being a different place.